Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Hiring used to be hard, multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through this site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/M-U-R-D-E-R. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer. The names of notorious serial killers are usually well known. They echo in the news and in public consciousness. But most people have never heard of Israel Keyes, one of the most ambitious and terrifying serial killers in modern history. The FBI considered his behavior unprecedented. Described by a prosecutor as a force of pure evil, Keyes was a predator who struck all over the United States. He buried kill kits, cash, weapons, and body disposal tools in remote locations across the country. Over the course of 14 years, Keyes would fly to a city, rent a car, and drive thousands of miles in order to use his kits. He would break into a stranger's house, abduct his victims in broad daylight, and kill and dispose of them in mere hours. And then he would return home to Alaska, resuming life as a quiet, reliable construction worker devoted to his only daughter. When journalist Maureen Callahan first heard about Israel Keyes in 2012, she was captivated by how a killer of this magnitude could go undetected by law enforcement for over a decade, and so began a project that consumed her for the next several years, uncovering the true story behind how the FBI ultimately caught Israel Keyes and trying to understand what it means for a killer like Keyes to exist. A killer who left a path of monstrous, randomly committed crimes in his wake, many of which remain unsolved to this day. American Predator is the ambitious culmination of years of interviews with key figures in law enforcement and in Keyes' life, and research uncovered from classified FBI files. Callahan takes us on a journey into the chilling, nightmarish mind of a relentless killer and to the limitations of traditional law enforcement. The book that we're featuring this evening is American Predator, The Hunt for the Most Meticulous Serial Killer of the 21st Century, with my special guest journalist and author, Maureen Callahan. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Maureen Callahan.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us on this program. This is going to be an incredible interview about a truly incredible book about a truly incredible serial killer. We just mentioned it in the opening. Tell us how you came to learn about this case and why it was important for you to write this book. Tell us about that decision.
Well, I first came across this case in early December 2012. It was an article about a serial killer, the likes of which the FBI had never seen before. I got to the second paragraph, which detailed a modus operandi that was so astonishing and sophisticated, yet simple. I called Israel Keyes, an analog killer in a digital age, which helped him evade capture for at least 14 years, if not longer. The MO was as you described in your introduction, and I'm certainly happy to delve deeper into that. But the other thing that made it clear that this was a story that needed to be dug into and really explored was the admission that the FBI had kept this individual's existence secret from the American public for the 9 months that they had him in custody. And given that his killing spree extended all over the United States, that seemed not in the public interest. And so that was going to be at least one mystery to explore, but it was clear that there would be multiple mysteries to explore. And as I researched and reported year after year, I could never have expected the things that I discovered.
Yeah, certainly. Absolutely. Now, you start American Predator with a victim named Samantha Koenig, which was 18 years old, and she's working at this little coffee shack we'll call a kiosk. This is February 2012. Tell us about the Samantha Koenig and why she's working, and tell us about this kiosk and this business and what happens that night.
So on the evening of February 1st, 2012, an 18-year-old girl named Samantha Koenig is closing up her coffee kiosk, the kiosk where she works in Anchorage, Alaska. One of the things to know is that in Anchorage, these coffee kiosks are extremely common. They're like little shacks almost. They abut the sides of roads. Samantha's was right next to a very well-trafficked road and sat in a parking lot right near a big-box gym. The other thing to know is that the culture in Anchorage is such that these teenage girls are often working these kiosks alone. Samantha disappears that night. The next morning, she's reported missing the next morning when the next young woman comes in to open the kiosk, which has been locked, but she sees that all of the cash in the register is missing. It's a little bit messy in there. Samantha's a neat freak. She is known to clean up meticulously. The evening before, however, her boyfriend had received text messages from Samantha's phone in which she indicated that she was very upset with him. She knew exactly what he had been up to, and she was taking off for a few days with some of her friends. So initially, law enforcement is looking at this as a potential runaway scenario. It's compounded by Samantha's history. She had an unstable upbringing. She had had her own issues with substances. Law enforcement didn't look at, well, they made several mistakes, one of which is they never taped off that scene. They didn't treat it as a crime scene. They sort of made their assumptions. And so that kiosk and its surrounding areas were contaminated. They did not get a look at the surveillance video from inside the kiosk until later that evening. So it's almost 24 hours. And once they do, they see a figure outside ordering a coffee, a man who looks to be tall. A few minutes go by, and suddenly he leaps in through the kiosk's window. And when I say leap, and you can see the surveillance video online, he arcs his body like a cheetah, and he pounces in there. What confounds investigators is that they spend another 11 minutes in that kiosk before leaving. So one of them in particular, a very, very seasoned investigator, is thinking to himself, these two are in there for 17 minutes. What on earth could they possibly be talking about? The next theory becomes the accomplice theory, that Samantha is in on her disappearance with an unknown individual for money. Later, as weeks go by, and a ransom note is discovered, which contained a photo of Samantha, made up, hair braided, eyes wide open, facing the camera, a newspaper, a proof of life photo, a newspaper dated weeks after her disappearance. The investigators are again confounded. All but one of them thinks that Samantha is alive. The FBI at this point is involved, and they bring in an expert in snuff films. That expert cannot tell. And it's not until Samantha's ATM card begins pinging in the lower 48, the FBI now has a tracker on it, that a man named Israel Keyes is arrested on the side of the road in Texas. And in his car, they find Samantha's ATM card and her cell phone. Israel Keyes, previously unknown to law enforcement in any capacity, and he's arrested, and he's not talking.
You talk about the arrest of Israel Keyes, but you introduce very crucial characters in this story, and that being FBI agent FBI Steve Payne. And you talk about the lead detective in this, in Anchorage Police Department, this Monique Dahl. You interestingly write about how Steve Payne gets involved with this, wants to be involved with this, but of course the jurisdiction and the ego involved with who's going to handle what. Tell us a little bit about this dynamic and introduce Steve Payne and this investigation and the team involved in that investigation.
Yeah, so initially the case is handled by the Anchorage Police Department, APD, because it's designated a missing persons. Mickey Dahl, that's how she's known, her full name is Monique Dahl, was a detective who was brand new to homicide. She was first day, and her superior thought that this would be a good case to field train a rookie. She came from DEA. She had 10 years experience there. So she's lead on this case, but in Anchorage, everyone knows everyone else. It's a big city that feels like a small town. So law enforcement, prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, they all know each other. And Payne at his FBI field office gets a call from a friend of his telling him about this missing girl, and he immediately wants to get involved. And the word back is, no, thank you. We think we know what this is. Later that afternoon, I would say around 5, 6, Payne gets a call from Mickey Dahl, and she tells him some things have changed. Can you come over? So he gets in his car and he races over to APD, and it's the surveillance video. Payne is looking at it. Dahl is looking at it. And Jeff Bell, he's the investigator who had the 17-minute theory. He's an amazingly multifaceted, multi-talented investigator. He's U.S. Marshals. He's SWAT. He's got FBI clearance. He's worked drugs. He's seen and done it all. And is relatively young, by the way. I mean, this is how talented this guy is. And he's got eyes on the video, too, now. And so they are all beginning to work together, and yet there is a clashing of, I don't know if I would call it egos, but it's definitely a power struggle. Payne's got all the resources of the FBI at his disposal to help with this case. Mickey Dahl's on it for less than 24 hours. She's a woman. She feels this is her case, and she does not want the FBI bigfooting her. Jeff Bell is kind of caught in the middle. He's sort of a peacemaker and always looking to mediate. He can always see both sides. What's interesting is the team really comes together once that ATM card begins pinging in the Southwest. It's important to realize that at this point, Samantha's been missing for 5 weeks, 6 weeks. So the more time that goes by, the more that they're thinking, you know, Samantha is not going to have a good outcome here. And what they now need to rely on all the way up in Anchorage is a coordinated, multi-jurisdictional effort among law enforcement, people that they do not know and who may not feel the urgency of this case. Because who they're being asked to chase, their subject is a white male, tall, athletic, middle-aged. He is driving the most commonly rented car in the United States of America. They can't pinpoint his location. He's moving too far, too fast. Find him somehow. And it's the Texas Rangers, and in particular, a ranger named Steve Rayburn and a corporal named Brian Henry, who take this vague information and they consolidate it, and Rayburn is hand-walking it to everyone he can. Look for this vehicle. Let's canvas particularly hotels. The area in which the ATM card is being used seems to be, you know, more and more concentrated. One of the analysts on this case called it nesting. The subject was nesting. And they put eyes on a rental vehicle that's parked in a complex that has three hotels. So you're talking hundreds and hundreds of rooms. And they look at where this car is parked. One of the investigators looks up and they see a white male two stories above on a balcony looking directly down at that car, and they put eyes on him, and they follow this car, and Henry is two cars behind this guy as he's heading toward Route 59. Like, he's about to get away, and he can't pull him over. He has no reason, and he's getting orders from Rayburn over the radio, find a reason to pull him over. And he pulls out his radar gun, and this vehicle goes 2 miles over the speed limit. He puts on his lights, and to his amazement, this rental car pulls over to the side of the road. And when he approaches the car, and he says, "Where are you from?" And the man says, "Alaska." The way Henry described it, his heart stopped, because in his 20 years in law enforcement, he had never pulled over anyone from the state of Alaska. And right then, they knew.
What do they find in his possession regarding that ATM card? And what else did they find in that vehicle?
It's very interesting because by now, so Rayburn comes on the scene, and with him is an FBI field agent, Special Agent Deb Ganaway. So they come on the scene, and Ganaway immediately calls Steve Rayburn. Steve Payne in Anchorage.
Right.
And she says, "Listen, we've pulled over a suspect in your case." And Payne says, "What do you have on him? What did you have to pull him over?" And she says, "Not a lot." Now, this flags for Payne because he's worried about fruit of the poison tree, right? If they execute a search that's unwarranted, no matter what they find in his possession can get thrown out and keys can walk.
Right.
Ganaway says to him, "Listen, I want you to understand, you should know something. In Texas, we have an exemption. And if we think that there is probable cause to search someone's vehicle, we can do it." And Payne really thinks about this hard for a moment. And then he says, "I don't want you to cut this guy loose without searching that car. And it doesn't matter to me how you do it." Which is highly unusual for him. He's a by-the-book guy. So they search Keyes' car, and inside they find immediately, like just eyeballing the car, Ganaway's suspicious because she sees folded up maps in the front seat. She sees rolled up cash with the dye packs have exploded. This guy clearly has been robbing banks. He's got little girls' paraphernalia in the back seat. They open up the trunk. The trunk is this weird treasure trove of like booze and pornography, and there's ski masks and there's headlamps. And then they find Samantha's cell phone, and it's broken apart and the battery's out. He won't say anything. And Rayburn turns to Corporal Henry because he wants him to have the honors of bringing him into custody, and he says, hook him up. And they handcuff him, and they take him into custody. And in his wallet, they find Samantha's ATM card with her access code scratched into the face of it. And they say, do you want to tell us what you're doing with this? And he says, I'm not telling you anything. Within minutes of his arrest up in Anchorage, Jeff Bell and Mickey Dahl are getting on a plane to fly to Texas. And they get down there, and it takes a long time to fly out of Anchorage to anywhere in the lower 48. There's no such thing as a direct flight. You have to stop in Seattle, right, and you have to lay over. So they get there, and they're exhausted, and they're hungry, and they're tired, and they are in the most high-pressure interrogation they've ever been in. And Bell gets into the room, and the way he described it to me, he said, the hairs on my back stood up, like on the back of my neck. They stood up. He was like, it was a feeling of pure evil. And I knew that he had Samantha, and I knew that she was dead, and I knew that he had done this before. And so their priority is to get Keys onto a story. Any story, doesn't matter, but get him to admit some connection. So Mickey Dahl takes the lead, and she says, I don't think that you're a monster. I think you had a reason for what happened, and I want to hear it from you. And he hums and haws, but when he's really confronted with the ATM card and the cell phone, he says, oh, now I know how I'm involved in this. And that's when the investigators start revving up. They're like, okay, here comes the story. And he says that he's a contractor, which they must know by now, and he had a client who owed him money and couldn't pay, and he found the ATM card and the cell phone in a baggie on his driver's seat that must have been slipped in through a cracked window, because they must know also he smoked cigars. They searched his car, and that was the long and the short of it. And he otherwise does not know Samantha Koenig and has not heard that she's disappeared and can't help them. He will not say anything else. And Payne is back in Alaska drawing up the strongest federal indictment he can, which is only fraud with access device. That's all they've got him on, that ATM card.
Right.
He needs to get Keys back to Alaska. They can get a full confession. And they get him back to Alaska. It takes a couple of weeks. In that time, by the way, that extradition process, there is an unexplained stop, which I only obtained through fighting with the federal government and at one point suing the federal prosecutor in the case for a lot of things that they were hiding regarding this case.
Wow.
They have an unexplained stop in Oklahoma City, which I can circle back to later if you like. But
sure, certainly.
They get Keys into this room, finally, in Alaska. And Steve Payne and Jeff Bell are wargaming out how they are going to get a full confession out of Keys when they have a serious dearth of evidence. Because if Keys sticks to this story, as outlandish as it is, and as clear of a lie as it is, he's going to walk. They don't have anything else. And they need to figure out a way to leverage this dearth of evidence into a full confession. And Payne explained his approach to me, which was there are a fair amount of investigators who like to take in a bunch of props. They'll come into a room with like stacks of folders and boxes and say, this is everything we've got on you. And in fact, those boxes are empty and the paper is blank. And Dean prefers a counterintuitive approach. He's a minimalist and he likes to go in with really almost nothing and say, listen, I'm not going to tell you everything that we have on you. And he finds that that almost always works. So Payne and Bell are wargaming this out, and it's the last minute they get a call from the federal prosecutor who's been assigned to this case. And to their horror, he has another idea. And if you want to talk about a clash of egos, his idea is that he, an individual with no experience with violent crime and who has no business in that room, is going to lead the interrogation of Israel Keyes. And there's no fighting this. For some reason, Cain and Bell politically felt they had to fall in line, and they had to teach this guy really fast, as best they could, how to sit across from a hardened criminal who has clearly done this before, a predator who can no doubt smell fear, have a sixth sense for it, and teach him how to go in that room with almost nothing and get this guy to tell everything. And that confession is another thing that the government has kept hidden all these years. I was able to obtain it through a source who wishes to remain anonymous. And, you know, those parties involved would probably say the reason that that confession has been kept secret all these years is because the details of what was done to Samantha are too gruesome for public consumption, to which I say,
right,
those details are easily redacted. Those are actually really not the salient parts of the confession. The salient parts of the confession are how this confession was elicited. It is a masterclass because not only does Steve Payne wrest control artfully away from Kevin Feldes, the prosecutor, who is bungling it left and right. I mean, at one point he admits practically to Israel Keyes that the team recovering evidence from his residence took the wrong shed in which he had had Samantha for 4 weeks. But what the person who really comes in and saves it, at Israel Keyes' request, is none other than Mickey Dahl. He says,
yeah,
you want to know everything? I want to talk to Mickey Dahl. And she comes in the next day, and she really delivers a masterclass in how you interrogate a suspect and get him to tell you everything you need to know in order to put him away. But what also comes out of that interrogation is an astonishing admission where Key says to them, I have a lot more stories to tell. And someone in that room says to him, you know, it's after he also says he wants to take control back in some way, as so many of these guys do. And he says to them, there is nobody who knows me or who has ever known me who knows anything about me, really. I am two different people, basically. And someone in that room says, how long have you been two different people? And Keith chuckled, and he said, a long time, 14 years.
Yeah.
And so now they know they've got to get another confession. And they've got to get another confession fast because they need to know exactly who they're dealing with. And the FBI special agents in this case go directly to Quantico, and they go to the top criminal profilers, and they say, please listen in. Tell us what you think. Give us some guidelines, some tips, so we can leverage more information out of him. And they're pretty quickly told, we don't know what to tell you. We have never seen one like this before.
You write about the FBI suggesting that they look at everything that Israel Keyes had looked at in terms of fiction and nonfiction, especially in true crime. What did the FBI want to determine from that, and what did they determine from looking at all that material?
Part of it was they wanted to determine how he had created this singular, unprecedented modus operandi, which involved buying one-way plane tickets, flying into major hubs, renting a car, driving hundreds or thousands of miles, burying up one of unknown kill kits he stashed all over the United States. These kill kits were 5-gallon Home Depot buckets that Keith had filled with guns, ammo, zip ties, cash from bank robberies he had previously committed, along with Drano, which he realized accelerated human decomposition. He would then go on the hunt, and he would hunt for anyone. Unlike most serial killers who have a definite victim profile, and I point as an example to his hero, Ted Bundy, who went after young white women with long straight hair parted down the middle. Keith would go after anyone. Young, old, black, white, male, female, fit, overweight, alone, in a couple, traveling in a pair. He was a craven opportunist when it came to his hunts and his kills. Keith Kane described him as a true ambush predator. He would jump out of nowhere lightning fast and take someone and move them to another location, or two people to another location, rape, torture, and kill them, move the remains to yet another location, preferably across a state line, dispose of those remains so expertly that he left no trace of DNA behind, and immediately put hundreds, if not thousands, of miles between himself and that crime scene. And by the way, from the moment he boarded that first plane out of Anchorage, Alaska, he has now turned off his cell phone, ripped out the battery, and is only using cash. He has, as he calls it, gone dark, making it nearly impossible to link him to any missing person or cold case in the country. So the FBI, aside from that monumental task of identifying and locating other victims over a 14-year span, if not longer, because you are dealing with the ultimate unreliable narrator, wants to see how Keith has sort of cooked this up. So they execute a search of the house he's shared with his girlfriend, who is a travel nurse, and Keith's 10-year-old daughter, to whom he is, by all accounts, extremely devoted. They find fiction, such as Dean Kutz's Intensity, a novel that is told from the dueling perspectives of a serial killer and his latest victim. They find films. They find, to their great surprise, books written by FBI profilers. And they ask him about this. And he says, "The first time I realized I was not the only person like this was when I was 14 years old and I read Mindhunter by John Douglas." Yeah. John Douglas, who is, I'm sure you know, one of the most legendary criminal profilers in the Bureau.
Right.
He also told them he read Dark Dreams by Roy Hazelwood, an equally legendary profiler who passed away not too long ago, but who I was lucky enough to talk to while I was writing this book about Keith. And Hazelwood's book was a revelation. I mean, Keith would rattle off these titles, and, you know, Jeff Bell had never heard of Dark Dreams. Someone else on the team had never heard of Dark Dreams. I mean, they would run out and get these books. They would watch the movies that Keith watched. They would, if they had assembled these little libraries, they had their own personal syllabi going. And what was revelatory about Hazelwood's book was that he was really the first to put to paper a taxonomy of the lust-driven serial murder and the traits that they had in common, one of which, to everyone's surprise, was compulsive driving. Definitely a trait Keith shared. I mean, this guy drove, you know, the mileage he put on rental cars was unbelievable. And at one point in the investigation, you know, Jeff Bell is trying to game out how many states Keith could have traveled to on like a 4-day trip to Texas based on the mileage he put on his rental car alone And I describe the scene in the book. He's using string and a compass and a map of the United States. And thumbtacks, and after he's tacked everything together and put his circles together, he steps back and he looks at the map and he says to himself, "This is unbelievable." He's realized that he's drawn circles around 13 states.
Yeah.
So he tells them that with Hazelwood's book, even though he really stressed his originality and did in his way want to be recognized for it, he did borrow one fantasy that is particularly horrifying that had been relayed to Hazelwood by another killer who had been caught, another serial murderer. And this involved staking out a deserted country road late at night, pitch black, hunkering down with a rifle, waiting for a lone driver to pass by, shooting out a tire, waiting for that car to slow to its inevitable crawl and stop, and then coming up behind and taking that driver. And he said that that was a fantasy he had just yet to get to. So they are learning to their horror that a monster like Keyes is in part being built by them.
What is the agreement that he has with this team of investigators? What are his demands regarding the press and his family, and do they honor those requests? Tell us about this agreement.
So Keyes makes several demands at the outset. He says, "I want the death penalty, and I want it fast. I do not want to be sitting in a supermax for the rest of my life while my case gets litigated in court, while anti-death penalty lawyers or groups protest my execution. I don't want any of it. I know there's no jury in this country that wouldn't convict me, let alone give me the death penalty. So get it for me." And Keyes knows that D.C. is listening in. He knows that Quantico is listening in. He knows the Department of Justice is listening in. He's very, very savvy, despite, by the way, having zero formal education and being raised up in the woods by off-the-gridder parents who hate the federal government. He knows how everything works. He says, "If you do this for me, if you wrap this case up within a year and get me that death penalty agreement, I'll give you the names and locations of all my victims." He also tells them he does not want them talking to his family. He wants them leaving his girlfriend alone. He wants his daughter completely insulated from all of it. And he wants his mother and his siblings, don't go near them. He says, "Well, if my mother wants to talk, actually, talk to her." But
right.
The siblings, nine of them he's got, all over the country. And the FBI accedes to this demand, and it's kind of incredible because, you know, they're not pushing very hard with the siblings at all. And then the third demand is, "I want you to keep my name out of the press. I don't want anybody knowing about me." His stated reason was he wanted to protect his daughter, but the real reason was probably he just didn't want the attention while he was alive. There are things that they do that they, for all their depravity and the extreme psychopathy, they know are shameful. He wanted to continue operating in the shadows, and he wanted to exert control. And, you know, the FBI tried to accede to all of this. And at one point, there's a reporter in Vermont who somehow links Israel Keyes to the disappearance in 2011 of a middle-aged suburban couple from their home in the middle of the night And that case was cold from the get-go. Nobody had any clue what happened to these people. It wasn't until Israel Keyes confessed to taking them and killing them. And by the way, the account he gave the FBI was so extraordinary, they didn't even believe it at first. And his name broke in Vermont. And Keyes found out about it because other demands he had were he wanted access to the New York Times, he wanted access to the internet, he wanted access to cigars he liked. I mean, he was the most high-value suspect Alaska had ever had in custody, and they had to figure out a way to take him outside so he could smoke his cigars. Once his name breaks, he's pissed. He says, I'm not talking to you anymore. And the case stalls for 3 months because Keyes just won't talk to them. And he's basically showing them who's boss. And it's quite humbling. And at that point, they really have nothing else to do but wait and hope that they can get him talking again.
What do they find out about his family life? They want to look into that background. He said stay away from the siblings, but what do they find out despite that about his background and possibly some reason for this aberration?
Well, it's interesting because the agent who was sort of tasked with that and who really took it on because she most probably more than anyone else was intrigued by that. Jolene Godin, you know, she told me that the minute he said stay away from my family, that she lasered in on that. Well, that's everything she wants to know about right there.
Right.
One of the most important things that investigators were able to get was a court-ordered psychological evaluation because he's wanted the death penalty so badly he needed to be ruled sane as fast as possible.
Right.
And so that psych eval happens really fast. And that, by the way, was another thing that I had to sue the federal prosecutor's office for. They kept that hidden since 2012, along with 13 hours of interrogations with Keyes that they had never logged anywhere. Their existence was unknown. And I was able to figure out that they existed because I had been talking to these agents for so long. So I obtained those things only last May. And I felt reading the psych eval the way that Jolene Godin must have felt, which was that it was a mother load. The greatest self-report that we had of Israel Keyes' upbringing to date. So he was born in Utah to Heidi and Jeff Keyes. He's raised as one of 10. He is the second oldest and the oldest boy. When Israel and his older sister, America, are either 4 and 2 or about 6 and 4, Heidi and Jeff uproot the family from Utah to a remote corner of Washington State called Colville. And they do that because the neighbors are getting very suspicious about the welfare of these toddler children who they never see outside. Heidi goes on to have 7 more children. They're all home births. The children never get a birth certificate. They never get a social security number. They never see a doctor. They are raised outdoors for 7 years while Jeff builds a cabin by hand. They live in tents. The food they eat, they either grow it or they hunt it. By the time Israel is 10, he knows how to shoot to kill, how to dress game, how to cook it. They are fervent, off-the-gridders. They loathe and distrust the federal government of the United States. They are always sure, from this point on, to pretty much live near a border where they can get to Canada quickly. They join a church, a white supremacist church called the ARC, where Israel befriends two brothers named Chevy and Shane Kehoe, mm-hmm. who will later go on in the 90s to become among the FBI's 10 most wanted. One of the Kehoe brothers later implicates the other as a co-conspirator with Timothy McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombing. And in fact, mm-hmm. when Keyes is demanding the death penalty and the agents and prosecutors are trying to tell him that that is impossible to get that fast, he says that's a lie. Timothy McVeigh demanded the same thing and he got it really fast. And right. a lot of people I grew up with, by the way, regard Timothy McVeigh as a hero. By the time Keyes is 14, he is starting fires. He is breaking and entering into neighbors' houses, sometimes simply just rearranging the furniture so that he can watch them return home from a little mm-hmm. bit away and experience their fear that someone's been in their home. He is not just stealing guns and buying guns. At 14, by the way, he looks like a grown man. He's really tall. Actually, as early as 12, now that I think about it. But he's learning how to build guns. At 16, he tells his mother he wants to live by himself. And he hand-builds a cabin in less than a year. His dad took 7. Less than a year, he hand-built a cabin. He has also begun to manifest the textbook signs of not just psychopathy, but the extreme psychopathy that indicates a future serial killer. He has taken his sister's cat out into the woods with some friends and described tying that cat to a tree and shooting it in the stomach and watching that cat run around frantically and vomit and suffer and die a horrible death. And he's watching it and he's laughing and he looks over at another one of the kids there and that kid is turned around and is puking his guts out in terror and fear. And he says, that's pretty much the last time anyone went out into the woods with me. And he said, he told the psychological evaluator, the psychologist, that he was pretty sure his parents knew about that one of the kids had told his parents and the parents had gone to Jeff and Heidi. Now, I interviewed Heidi at length for this book, and to my knowledge, she has never spoken to a reporter since. She certainly had never spoken to one before. She told me she had no recall of that incident. The only incident she had recall of was her and Jeff discovering a cache of guns in Israel's cabin and thinking that at that point he really needed to move back home with them. But it was far too late by then because Keyes had told investigators that by age 14, and again, I'm going to say it's earlier than that, he had figured out that he was really good at sitting in the woods, deep in the woods, alone, still, 4 hours, and watching people. And having the epiphany that not only would it be easy enough for him to take someone and no one would ever know, but that he absolutely could do this and get away with it.
What about his stay in the military? It was a goal of his. Was he a good soldier? And what characterized his stay in the military? He didn't see any combat, you write. Tell us about what others thought of him and how he interacted with those other soldiers.
Israel Keyes' stay in the military is such a crucial part of this story, and so much of it remains unknown. What we do know and what I was able to uncover indicates that there is much more that we should certainly be made privy to. So if we start at the beginning, Israel Keyes, again, an individual who has no birth certificate nor social security number, walks into a recruitment office by his own account, is allowed to enlist in the United States Army.
Yeah.
I asked the Army if this was remotely possible, and they said absolutely not. So that's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI interviewed many of the men he served with, including his commanding officer. I had filed for his military file, and I got a scant few pages. The only page of interest being the fairly recent discovery of a human skull at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, where Keyes had been stationed, and clearly indicating that they needed to look at Keyes for that. But 201, all of these soldiers and his commanding officer described Keyes as outstanding, as singular, as a super soldier. One described him as having carried 150 pounds on his back 4 miles without flinching. One described him hand making what's known as a Gilles suit. And these are the suits worn by snipers. They sort of look like Bigfoot when they're done because they
right.
are extensively designed to camouflage you in any environment. But snipers in the Army are issued their Gilles suits, and they're made by experts. And somehow Keyes not only knew how to build one himself, but had permission to. It's never on record that he was trained as a sniper. He also, and this was a surprise to me, not just underwent, but easily passed Army Ranger training. That is a grueling, grueling, excruciating method that the Army really uses to flush out. Most people can't hack it. So
right.
he's, now we know, has had special forces training of some kind. I also uncovered in these previously sealed documents that he had gone down to Panama at one point for training that remains unknown. He told the FBI at a later point in this investigation that as a 14-year-old, he knew how to build explosives. He was building bombs. He has had told someone he served with that at property he owned in upstate New York, even back then we're talking 98, 99, he had buried 9,000 rounds of Black Talon ammunition on that property. Black
wow.
Talons are the outlawed so-called cop killer bullets.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in this case, the FBI, again, this has never been reported, and they've never explained why, they reclassify the Israel Keyes case. It is now no longer serial murder. It's terrorism. And they deploy bomb squads on either side of the country, one to his house in Anchorage and one to the property in upstate New York, and they have never said what they recovered. They have never said what they know Israel Keyes had ever done or what he was planning to do.
Let's get back to the interrogation of Israel Keyes. It's fascinating. You take us right into that interrogation room. You say that there's officers monitoring it. You've got Quantico on the phone being able to wade in. And then you have those people in the room. But you have this prosecutor Feldes with Steve Payne biting his nails. He gets lucky in this, gets very, very fortunate, as you write, because things could have went a lot differently given the strategy that he employed versus the strategy that the FBI and Steve Payne and others would have employed. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. you know, Kevin Saldes' approach, and you can hear some of these tapes, they're online, but the really meaty ones, the ones where you see how this interrogation could have gone sideways, and why I think it's so important to hear, especially for anyone who's studying for a career in law enforcement or as a federal prosecutor or as a defense attorney. These are really, they're so enlightening because Saldes' approach is almost one that's informed by what you would see in a movie or a television procedural, you know, where it's the interrogator comes in full of like piss and vinegar and like they've got all the control and you're just a scumbag that they're going to nail to the wall, so you may as well just tell me. And Kane goes in with far more humility. And the way he described his approach to me was, he says, I liken that very first interrogation with a suspect as telling an author his own story. And, you know, of course, it's only the author who knows how this story ends. So Kane and Bell are kind of being guardian angels as Saldes is sort of stumbling along, and they're trying to also figure out in what way Keyes is going to be most comfortable telling this narrative. And it becomes apparent that Keyes is much more comfortable working backward, working with timelines and logistics and where he was when, rather than getting right into how he took Samantha, what he might have done with her. And at one point, Keyes is walking himself up to giving the details of that night and what he did to Samantha. And they needed these details, crucially, because they had so little physical evidence linking Keyes to Samantha. And if at any point Keyes recanted his confession or wanted to throw in like an unnamed accomplice to the mix, they would be screwed. So they needed details that they could then very quickly corroborate. And at that point, he says, I'll give you these details, but there are too many people in this room. There need to be fewer people in this room. And immediately Steve Kane is thinking, okay, fine. Like, who would I leave in this room? And he goes, and in his mind, he's going, Jeff. Jeff is the best interrogator on this team. Kane has an ego that is strong enough to admit his strengths and weaknesses. So it would be Bell, and it would be Keyes' defense attorney, Rich Kirtner. And that would be it with him. That would be fine. And Saldes immediately goes, Wait. Let's hit the pause button on that. You know, I mean, only you know the details you're going to tell us is real. So why don't you just start telling us? And Keyes is really adamant. He's like, there are too many people in here. And Kane is like dying as like Saldes is like gripping this table with like white fingertips. Like he's not leaving that room. He wants to be in that room. They're beginning to realize this is a case that could be a star maker, you know. And Kane is thinking to himself, you know, I don't care what this guy's motivations are. I don't care if he needs some form of cosmetic privacy. I don't care what it is or if he really feels this ashamed of what he's done that he needs, like, fewer people in the room. I need those details. We need those details. And Saldes won't relent, and this is when like Keyes pushes his leverage back and he says, I'll give you all the details you want, but I want to talk to the lady detective. What's her name again? And they say Mickey Dahl, and he says, yeah, I want to talk to her. And Saldes is like, well why, you know? And he says, that's the way I want it. And in those moments, Kane and Bell are realizing that Keyes is putting this together. He's already put it together. that Feldis has no idea what he's doing. Why? Who holds all the cards in that room right now? It's your keys, you know? And Feldis had sort of misunderstood this dynamic from the outset. You know, he thought, as the federal prosecutor who had decided to run point on this interrogation, that he was the most powerful person in the room. But no, Israel Keyes was the most powerful person in that room.
When he went to ask questions, Feldis, and when Israel didn't like those questions, he also said that he would provide information, but not the bodies. He would give them some information, but they would have to figure out the bodies, and then he would confirm that he did kill that body. Tell us just a little bit about that incredible condition that he put forth.
Well, that consequence came about as a result of another stumble by the team, and by Feldis in particular. When they had some of the cards still, and Keyes was just agitating, get me the death penalty, get me the death penalty, the one thing Payne and Bell could say to him was, listen, one victim is not going to get you that. You want it fast, like, you got to give us something else. And after, you know, some deliberation and back and forth, Keyes says, okay, I'll give you two bodies and a name.
Yeah.
So this is three victims in 1 week, which really is remarkable progress. And he gives them the couriers and tells them this incredible story of winding up in Vermont on a road trip, on his way to visit brothers in Maine, stops there, dug up a kill kit, and is staying at like a local budget inn and starts walking around town that night. And it's raining. It's about 8 o'clock. He's staking out a parking lot. He's looking for a guy this evening. His fantasy this evening involves a guy. And he sees a yellow VW bug pull into the parking lot. It's an apartment complex. And he watches as this guy gets out of the car and puts a newspaper over his head. And Keyes starts following him. And he's getting closer and closer and closer. And as Keyes describes it, he's arcing out his arm to grab the guy by the back. And the guy breaks into a sprint to get out of the rain, and he runs. And he says, that guy almost got it that night. If that guy had been 5 seconds slower, he would have been the one. And so now he's got to look for something else and someone else. And he shifts his fantasy to a couple. And he lets a few hours go by in his hotel room, and he goes back out, and now it's about midnight, and he's walking around town, and a few minutes later, he finds himself staring at a house on a suburban street. And this is a middle-class neighborhood. This is a single-story ranch house. He's a contractor. He looks at it, and he figures out the layout. He knows exactly what it looks like inside. He starts prowling around the backyard. He sees an above-ground pool. He sees a grill. He sees no evidence of pets or small children. He has previously told the investigators, one thing I won't do is mess with kids, which is a remarkably self-serving statement for a serial killer to make. It's another one, too, another indicator that he's borrowing from his predecessors, both real and fictional, because that's a reference to the fictional serial killer Dexter, you know, the serial killer with a code, with a moral code, right?
Yeah, right.
He had told them that after his daughter was born, something in him shifted profoundly. But that statement, even if you were to believe it, which I do not, indicated that before his daughter was born, he had gone after children. But anyway, he's just looking for a couple with really no other impediments to getting to them. And he creeps around the house. He cuts the phone line, realizes there's no alarm system. They have no outdoor floodlights. They've got air conditioners that are in unit. You know, you shove them in the window. He can gain access. So he does that through their garage, gets in their car, finds a woman's driver's license, and he sees that there are a lot of tools in that garage. Okay, this is one. It's a man and a woman. Breaks in through the kitchen door, tells them it takes him 6 seconds flat to get from the kitchen to their bedroom. Wake them up, tie them up, restrain them. And that's it. He's taking them that night. Packs some luggage, roots around for some jewelry, some prescription drugs, puts them in their car, and drives them to a remote abandoned house that he says he had found the day before. And he tells them, he gives them another clue. He says, whenever I'm on a road trip, whenever I'm driving around, I always look for abandoned houses, especially ones with a for sale sign. I always stop at ones with a for sale sign. And he had gone in this house and he had seen it hadn't been lived in for years, if not decades. And it was abandoned. And there was a hole in the floor of one bedroom that dropped down right to the living room. There was a basement. It was off of a small road. It was perfect. And to him, it looked like a house of horrors. And he's driving them up to this house, and they are begging him to let them go, that they're old, they're sick, and they have no money. And if they would just let him go, they will give him everything they've got, and they will never tell a soul. And he tells them what he told Samantha Koenig the night he took her, that
right.
This was just a kidnapping for ransom, and they were going to be fine. And he was bringing them to a drop house where someone else would take this over. And he takes them into that house, and he visits upon them unspeakable horrors. And when he is done, he leaves their bodies in trash bags in the corner of the basement and tells the FBI that he had been planning to more thoroughly dispose of their remains, but he was running out of time because the sun was coming up and there was a small amount of traffic on the road of people going to work. And he figured that it would be fine ultimately because whoever bought the house, he thought, would either tear it down or burn it. And they were doing it for the property, and then they would just rebuild. And that anyone who even thought about going into the basement would think that they were smelling the stench of a dead wild animal and never take a look. And so, first of all, again, the agents don't believe what they're hearing, because what he's describing and what he's done to this couple who were, you know, they were infirm and they were slightly overweight, and the husband, Bill especially, was a big guy, and it really would have been hard to take one of them alone, aside from two of them. But the timeline he's giving them, you know, this is like 5 hours start to finish. So they send field agents to that house, and lo and behold, Keyes is right. It's already been torn down. It's been less than a year. He committed this crime in June of 2011, and he's telling them about it in March of 2012, and the house is gone.
Wow.
And so as Keyes is very interested in learning the progress of what's going on in Vermont, and one of the things he's saying is, listen, I gave you all these details. I want to see the pictures of the remains. And this again is an unfortunate tell on Feldis's part, because he asks why. He asks why, and he says, I want to see them. I just want to see them. That's the way I am. And
yeah.
Feldis realizes that he just wants to get off on seeing the decomposed remains, and it's now clear to Keyes that Feldis is terrified of him. But Keyes keeps asking over and over, and he asks Feldis, you know, a week has gone by now. Have they found the bodies yet? And Feldis says they haven't found the bodies. And Keyes is like, are you sure they have the right house? And Felda says, yeah. And Key says, well, that is extremely weird because those bodies should be very easy to find. It wasn't that big of a house. And Felda's is offering all these lame excuses left and right, but Keyes is beginning to piece it together. Like, they might not ever find these bodies. And in fact, they have to tell him because he's got access to the internet. Guess what, Israel? It looks like whoever bought this land, this house, they hired a crew to excavate the basement. And so the bodies are in the landfill, and the FBI is searching the landfill. And this becomes the largest such hunt in FBI history. And it goes on for weeks, and they can't find the bodies. And they have to tell Keyes they can't find the bodies. And now Keyes knows, really, that he holds all the cards. He said, I guess I spoke too soon on that one. He only gave them the couriers because they had his laptop. They had his computer, and they were going to find photos and news stories about the courier's disappearance, and he figured they would put that on him, and he may as well give them an easy one. And now he knows there's no such thing as an easy one.
Yeah, he's upset, and at some point, too, he tells them that he wasn't initially interested in fame, but now, or at some point, he decided he would. He was interested in infamy, wasn't he?
I think so. I think that because he was such a student, not just of the FBI's criminal profilers, but the depiction of killers like him in popular culture, because he was extremely interested in discussing his MO and what he considered his unique skill set, more so than his victims. The way I sort of describe it in the book, I say that he wanted them to know that in the history of monsters, he was a great.
Yes.
And I do think he just wanted to avoid it on his terms and to have that recognition also on his terms. He said that it was really about protecting his daughter. To some degree, that was true, but he was certainly, for all of his rural background without really any formal education, he was an extremely bright guy who certainly understood the basic principles of Google. So he knew that that was an inevitability. But, you know, again, he wanted it on his terms, and he went so far as to, you know, sort of happily tell them his future plans, one of which was inspired by the infamous serial killer H.H. Holmes, who is the subject of the great book Devil in the White City. And I'm sure all of your listeners are familiar with Holmes, but for anyone who's not, he built a dungeon in his mansion in Chicago during the World's Fair there, and he advertised it as a hotel, and really it was just an elaborate lore to have victims come to him, as Keyes described his favorite way to take someone. He said, back when I was smart, I would just let them come to me. And his dungeon he used as a place to hold his victims for a long time and torture them and rape them before killing them. And Keyes said that that was his plan. He really wanted, it was what he called his retirement plan, to build a big house with a dungeon where he could keep victims for much longer. And another more immediate plan that he had was to leave Anchorage and begin traveling the country as an itinerant construction worker, because he told them that there was no greater cover for moving around, offering his services as all of these increasing extreme weather events. And that plan that was diabolical and ingenious, quite frankly. And that coupled with really the unforced error he made when later he begins talking to them again and says, I know how to build bombs. You know, was that an unforced error or was that like another tantalizing clue he's using to taunt them with? Like, you don't know what I'm truly capable of. Try and figure it out. Maybe I'll help you. Maybe I won't. And I think that he truly was laying the groundwork for what he hoped his narrative would be. I want to say that said, I really went to great pains in this book to call Keyes what he is, a monster, a predator, a complete aberration. I explore with the help of Roy Hazelwood psychopathy, and to your earlier question about how Keyes's upbringing may have formed or malformed this individual. Are they born or are they made? But the larger point being, I in no way would ever want anyone to take away from this book that any of these acts are things to be glorified for. In fact, at one point, he tells the investigators, vis-a-vis relaying the details of his crimes, you know, hey, I'm not in this for the glory. You know, he realizes that the culture has this sick fascination and tends to glorify serial killers. I really hope that, if anything, it's the victims who are the sole focus of sympathy here and recognition, and that Keyes is what the FBI and Quantico regard him to be, which is a thing to be studied and to learn from.
You talk about how many, with this investigation, this incredible investigation and interrogation and his confession, how many bodies did they confirm that he had killed, that were confirmed? And then from the entirety, the totality of this interview, were they looking anywhere else for potential victims?
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. This is such a great question. So the official tally for the victims of Israel Keyes is 11. Keyes told them he had killed less than 12 people. Now, for Steve Payne, that was always a weird number. Steve Payne is a math guy, and he figured, okay, most people round up by fives or tens, so 12 is odd, so I'm going to figure 11. There are other investigators on this case, other agents, who believe that number is far more, and I am in that camp. He told them he had been doing this for 14 years. I think he started way earlier, and it's a conclusion I reached after, you know, 5 years of deep research and reporting on this case. I believe there are several cold cases that I explore in the book that I hope are reopened. Cold cases and unsolved missing persons cases, two completely different things, that law enforcement has reason to believe Israel Keyes is likely responsible for. And I say that based on information the agents gave me directly about their own suspicions. I say that based on hundreds of pages I got from the Department of Justice case files that involve both calls to the FBI's tip line and emails from both civilians and law enforcement all over the United States saying, please look at Israel Keyes for this. His MO fits the circumstances of the disappearance of my friend, my loved one, my husband, my son. I cross-reference those with another classified piece of information I was able to obtain, which was the FBI's secret internal timeline of Israel Keyes' known travels. This is far more detailed than the timeline that the FBI threw up online in about 2013, asking for the public's help in locating and identifying other victims of Israel Keyes. And when I got the secret timeline, which I only obtained last summer, so about a year ago, or maybe last fall, this was a revelation, because this timeline included information that came directly from journals and calendars that Keyes kept. And
right.
So they were able to put him at places where previously they might not have been able to. So in cross-referencing all these materials, there are about four or five cases revisited in the book that make a strong argument for another look. And I would close that out by saying that Keyes told them, he just gave them this. He said, "I buried one, but possibly two, victims in Lake Crescent in Washington." And I went to Lake Crescent because I visited with the FBI agents in Washington State who worked it. And it is one of the largest lakes in the United States of America. Until you see it, you can't comprehend how vast it is. At its deepest point, it's probably 700 feet. They've never been to the bottom of it. So Keyes said there's at least one down there. And the FBI checked with their experts. It's fresh water. There's very little marine life. The chances of preservation are remarkably good. And the agents in Washington State told me they went to the Bureau and they said, "We want to do a recovery operation." And the Bureau told them no, because they did not want to spend the money.
Yeah, incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Maureen, you also talk about, and we could spend hours and hours just going over some of the incredible details that are in this book, but you talk about the May 23rd, 2012, he's in court, and he tries to run from court, an incredible thing that Jeff Bell had predicted, that he thought, geez, I think he's going to do something. So he tries to run from court, and he was tasered. You also talk about some of the behavior that Ted Bundy exhibited as well, in terms of what they find out is that evidence that certainly he was into necrophilia. He was interested in necrophilia as well, among the other things that were traits of other serial killers as well.
Yeah. The necrophilia is never not shocking. With killers like these, and they are, as Roy Hazelwood called them, lust-driven serial murderers, it's really not that uncommon. The courthouse escape is really interesting and telling for so many reasons. Not least of which, you know, again, with Bundy escaped when he was in custody in Florida when they finally got him. He escaped from prison. And I believe he may have also had a courthouse escape attempt, if not success. So Keyes is in federal court, and he's sitting at the table with his defense attorneys. He's surrounded by U.S. Marshals. The courthouse is packed. The press is there. And Jeff Bell is there, as is Steve Kane. But Bell, particularly, the way he sort of described this to me, he's watching Keyes look back over his shoulder at an attractive young woman. And she's a reporter, Bell thinks. And he keeps doing this. And he can't tell if Keyes is flirting with her or trying to intimidate her or what. But Bell starts moving himself over to break Keyes' eye line so that he can no longer make eye contact with this girl. And Keyes shoots him a look that's like daggers. And the court begins its proceeding. And suddenly, Israel Keyes jumps up. His leg chains are unlocked somehow, and he has, think about what this would look like. He's jumped up over his chair, his hands are still handcuffed in front of him, and he is leaping over benches. He's going bench by bench by bench by bench. But like, think about the athleticism and the balance and just the sheer defiance. And the courthouse erupts, and Jeff Bell leaps up to go after him, and the U.S. Marshals grab him, and they tase him, and Keyes is on his back, and Bell is looking at Keyes' expression, and he sees it's one of ecstasy. And it's again, it's another moment where even someone as seasoned as Bell is just completely floored by the monster he is dealing with. And he later learns that Keyes was able to make that attempt by taking the cellophane that had been used to wrap his sandwich, which he had been given in the courthouse. He was given the standard issue sandwich, an apple and milk carton with a straw and in a paper bag. And so he took that piece of cellophane and he worked it up in his mouth, and he somehow unlocked his leg irons, and he used a flimsy piece of cellophane to keep them together until he was ready to make a run for it. And if, by the way, if you try to find footage of that escape attempt, which made national news, and there's video of it, it's all been taken down. And why, I have no idea. But this became yet another battle for Jeff Bell, who was the investigator who day after day would go to the courthouse. He had the best rapport with Keyes. He would go and say, do you want to talk? Do you want to come out? Like, we'll take you out. You can go to the FBI's offices. We'll have some lunch. You can read the paper. But he was the most diligent about eyeing Keyes and what he was capable of. There was a day at the FBI where he noticed Keyes was working his jaw subtly, and Bell forced him to open his mouth, and in there were little shards of pencils that Keyes was fashioning into weapons. They were never in a room with him, unarmed, without guards there. You know, Jeff Bell would watch, as would the other agent, as Keyes would just sort of eyeball the room. Like, he would be looking at electrical sockets. He would be looking at, what can I make something out of? What can I make into a weapon to get out of here? He was found with a razor blade. Jeff Bell had to go to the head of the correctional facility and say, you guys can't give this guy anything. Because there was a day where Jeff Bell was strip searching Keyes before leaving, which was standard procedure. And there was always an armed guard outside that room. And after Bell finished his strip search of Keyes, the armed guard had just wandered off. And so now Bell is alone in this room with this guy who, he has rapport with on a professional level, but he is not fooled. Like, he knows that Keyes would kill him just as soon as talk to him. And Jeff Bell is terrified. Like, he was very honest about it. And he had to knock on the door from the inside without evincing any fear to get a guard to come back and unlock that door. And so, you know, he's basically saying, how lax can you guys be? Like, don't you understand who this is? And don't you understand that he can make things out of anything? Like, you, and so this was an ongoing battle that was waged. But it was just yet another example of Keyes's extreme lethality. I mean, Bell found in his cell one day, like, he was getting survivalist magazines in jail.
Excuse me. Yes. I want to thank you very much. I've got to cut this short. I want to thank you very much for this interview, American Predator, The Hunt for the Most Meticulous Serial Killer of the 21st Century. Just before I close, is there a website or a Facebook page we might access?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure speaking with you. You can find American Predator wherever books are sold, and you can find me at MaureenCallahan.net.
Thank you very much, American Predator, the hunt for the most meticulous serial killer of the 21st century. Thank you very much, Maureen Callahan. Good night.
Thank you so much. Bye.